Me, no, me, I'm Peter Hicks and I'm chairing for today as best as I can, so we'll see how we go. And I'd like to introduce to you Stephen Downes, and I'll give you all the opportunity in a minute to introduce yourselves to Stephen so that you know where we're going. But I thought first I'd just give you a bit of a rundown on Stephen so that you're sure you're in the right room and everything else. If you don't have it, there are copies of a bit of a program we're going to try and stick to, but we are trying to be as open and free as we can, so if you want to get up and go out or get coffee, whatever, please feel free to do so. There is a full hour set for lunch and you'll be most welcome to work through lunch if you want to. Stephen may not want to, but we'll see how we go with that. We're going to have to be reasonably firm with time. So just a little bit about Stephen. He's a senior research officer with the National Research Council of Canada in Moncton, New Brunswick, and he's affiliated with councils in the Institute for Information Technology. He works with the e-learning research group. His principal work involves research and development in e-learning, working with institutions and companies to improve their competitive position in the industry and outreach through articles, seminars and workshops. Previous to that position, Stephen was an information architect employed by the Faculty of Extension at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and he's employed on a contract position to design and build a major internet resource called Muni Mall, which I think, Stephen, is Municipal Mall for the Municipal Council. Before working at the University of Alberta, he was employed as a distance education and new instructional media design specialist with Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba, Canada. Prior to that, he taught philosophy by distance for Athabasca University and has a BA and MA. Some of the other interesting bits, he's very much into science fiction and books in general, enjoys movies and especially sport in the way of hockey. I know for a fact he loves playing darts over a couple of beers. And NCN trivia, but at Moncton you can't get that on the way. Yeah. So welcome, Stephen, and thank you very much to come along today to our e-learning nuts and bolts session. We've gathered together people that are involved in education and training from an industry perspective, where many have worked for the education systems in Tasmania and other mainland states, and also in content development. And we also have then a mix of Department of Education, University and TAFE people present. What I'd like to do to kick off with initially is just have you briefly introduce yourself to Stephen so that he's aware of where you come from, what your main interests are. So we can perhaps start with you.
Okay, Judy Travis, and work with the Department of Education, and I'm a failed darts player.
Can I maybe mention a recording?
Oh yes, I apologise. Stephen wants to make a recording of today, and we'd ask if you would all be kind enough to give permission for that.
Yep. It's all on the website.
Do we get a copy?
You can get a copy. Yeah, it'll go on my website. It'll be advertised in my newsletter, and you can download a copy. And it's all Creative Commons. You can use it, abuse it, do whatever you want with it.
Jeff Everson with Distance Education Tasmania.
Carol Bond, I've worked with both these range of projects over the last few years. The best practice and good practice and flexible learning in 2001, and features on our website.
Phil Dugger with the Department of Education, Learning Architecture Program.
Jo Murray, I work on quite a few of the framework projects in flexible learning toolboxes in mentoring in learning design, and the Knowledge Tree Journal, bringing the stuff that people are learning out of flexible learning leaders project into the public eye, and mentoring on the learning leaders project as well.
Janine Bowes from the Department of Education, involved in the delivery of the LEAP project.
Penny Anderson, Department of Education, and I'm in the curriculum standards and support area, which includes the support through e-learning delivery, etc.
Chris Carson from the Education Department. I'm part of the LEAP project.
Bill Anderson, Department of Education, Business Strategy. Stephen Brain from TAFE Tasmania. I'm a web technologist.
Marcus Regis from TAFE Tasmania. I'm currently working with the Emerging Paul Cannon, School of
Information Systems.
Becky Forstall, flexible learning leader, working in small private RTO, and my passion is facilitation and learning about open source.
Yeah, Michael Hyatt, so glad we're at ICT, and I've got out here, and facing flexible e-learning is what we're interested in. I'm researching now open source, things like Plone, that sort of stuff at the moment.
Hi, I'm Erica from the Learning Edge, and we have met in Canberra before.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and Chris Jones from Kitech Solutions and also the Learning Edge, and I spend most of the time on the mainland, but I'm more focused on the commercial aspects.
Craig Delsado from Raw Film, amongst other things, e-learning content development for the national initiative in Australia, and also moving into the UK market.
All right, thank you all very much. I thought what we'd do next is just run briefly through what we've got in mind to happen today, but it's not all set in concrete, so we can flex a bit. But just briefly, some people have requested that they do a 5 to 10 minute presentation, and we'll be pretty critical if you go to 10 minutes and 1 second, so I'll just give you a bit of a warning on that one. And that's what we have at the moment by way of requests, and I'm quite happy to accept some others at the end of that, going through those if people feel they need to say something else. Following on from that, we'll ask Stephen to comment at the end of each presentation initially, and then we'll open up for discussion amongst yourselves so you can discuss with Stephen and the group generally as to where we might be heading in the future in that area. That should, I think, take us through till about the lunch break, but we'll see how we're going. Following on from that, we've received from those invited to attend today a number of questions, and we're looking for some answers from you, Stephen, so we'd like you to earn your lunch and everything else, so we'll see how we go. So this is just a listing of the questions, and hopefully some of you will recognise that you are the one that submitted these, and we'd ask that you can speak a little bit to that question. And then Stephen has to depart on the dot at 2:30, and he's heading out to Strawn, and hopefully you have a good time, and we wish you well for that, Stephen. I mentioned a number of Stephen's passions in the latter bit of introducing him, but some of you may or may not be aware, I think a passion that Stephen doesn't let us know about is his photography. And if you go to his site, he has an album or repository of photos, and he started that with Australia already. So we've just grabbed some of these from Tourism Tasmania, Stephen, just to entice you a little more so, but I dare say you've done a fair amount of research on Strawn. Okay, we'll head back to... Is there anything anyone else would like to add to or say that they would want to do?
I was just going to say, Lizby is good to stay if you go on. You haven't got the courage. Oh, good.
Okay, so we might just head off with the presentation, and Bill Aronson will first cab off the rank.
Sorry, I put it there because there's an exclamation at the end of my...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think it should actually be a big question mark.
Yes, there is.
Business Strategy is a new unit within the Department of Education that's been brought together by people in... most of whom have come out of IMB. I've just come across from a different department to manage it. We spent the last few weeks sitting down talking to as many people as we can get round to as possible, and we're continuing that process just to understand what people think a business strategy unit should do. I guess in the context of this discussion, if there's a need for a business strategy unit, that the assumption must be that the Department of Education can do strategy better. And rather than that being focused and concentrated in a small group of people, It would seem to me that the best thing we could do would be to support the existing strategic thinking which is happening and try and strengthen a strategic thinking culture. So in other words, if everyone just naturally thinks strategically, you wouldn't need to have a specific unit which does it. And I think it's a kind of similar to the work which has happened on project management. Project management was really not very well understood 5 or 6 years ago across the whole of Tasmanian government, except for islands of excellence. And there's been a lot of work done on that area so that people do understand project management, and there's training available, and there is skill work which people can do. And I don't think the same thing has happened in terms of strategic thinking. So perhaps that's a direction that we can take. The other thing that we're looking at in terms of projects which would have an impact across the whole of the department, I think the thing which we're most interested in is in two areas which are kind of connecting with each other. One is enterprise architecture, and there's a lot of at this point not many people know what enterprise architecture is, and there are different interpretations of what it is. So we need to get a common understanding across the department what enterprise architecture is. And the second thing is in the way that projects actually get done. People understand how to manage a project, lead a project, and do the documentation for a project. But how do projects actually get up? And I don't think the department's any different from many organisations in this sense. They get up because people who know how to get the money, who know how to get the right people involved and supportive, and how the systems work, work their way through and manage to get their projects up. So theoretically, there are high-level committees which are meant to assess and say, okay, well, this project's more important than that one. But I don't know if they really have a true image of the whole enterprise to be able to say, no, if we do this project before this one, it's going to have this benefit. If we do this one before, it's going to be less of a benefit. So how do we put in place systems which will enable that whole process of how projects go from cradle to grave to be more transparent? Within the Department of Education, there's probably sort of three major areas. There's the library, there's the schools, and there's corporate services. I mean, there's other little bits and pieces, but those three major areas.
Okay.
I'm allowed to make these mistakes because I've only been on board for 3 weeks. thank you for correcting me.
Later on, Phil.
Okay. Within the schools and the education side, the LEAP project, which Phil will be talking about, has actually gone a long way to creating a much more architected solution. And I think corporate services, we're probably lagging behind. So in terms of what we plan to do, I think our main emphasis, certainly in the first year, will be to look at corporate services and try and learn some of the lessons from the LEAP project. So that's us. I think I've probably done my 5 minutes.
You're a bit over time. We're going to let you go to 10. Thank you very much, Bill. Steve?
Okay. Well, actually, just to preface again, because these are the first words I get to speak. just so that you're all warned, it's a very interesting exercise for me because, of course, I've been forewarned about none of the topics and none of the presentations, so I'm really reacting off the cuff here, and so I'm going to have to put in a little caveat, right?
and I'm going to play with the mic a little bit too, because it's kind of directional also, and kind of not directional. So yeah, a little bit of a caveat, you're getting the off-the-cuff remarks. So looking at what was said, you see, they've actually allowed me to do a little evaluation of project proposals in my new position. My new position is now about 3 years old, but it's still to me my new position because I work for the government now. And so I passed the security clearance, which is actually a miracle in itself. I think that was the hardest part of the job interview. Am I going to pass security? What have I done? Oh my. My experience with that and my experience on the other side, because I have been loosely associated with various people who have done project proposals, is, as you suggest, it's the usual suspects, right? The people who understand the system, the people who have the project submission background, and you can see that reflected in the process, because you know, you read a proposal, there's always a reading between the lines, and the reading between the lines is, oh yeah, I remember when he did that, or oh yeah, I know that they'll do such and such, even though there's no real evidence for that, but you know, they've done it before. So and consequently, as time goes by, and my view is that we've seen this in Canada, as time goes by, it sort of stagnates. Particularly in Canada, we have multiple granting agencies. And so the same project kind of makes the rounds. And the proposal gets better and better each time. It's pretty much the same proposal and the same people. I suggested to them, and nobody agreed with me on this, but I thought it was a good idea. Just to offer grants and without outcomes, without conditions. They wouldn't be huge grants, but there would be a lot of them. And they'd be enough to fund a person or two, you know, for a period of time to do what they think is relevant. And the reason I suggest that is because, I mean, the people are being selected to a certain degree, and they're being selected to a degree based on qualifications, to a degree based on interest, to a degree based on their previous work, but they're not being selected based on what they plan to do. And the reason for that is, as you suggested in your talk, the wisdom in this field is not concentrated in the central granting authority, and it's certainly not concentrated in the small committee that actually looks at the grant proposals and makes their suggestions. And in fact, when you look at the mechanics of decision making, the use of a review committee to consider proposals is actually more likely to produce incorrect results, because they're more likely to have a narrower view on the field than the people working in the field as a whole do. So that's my reaction to grant proposals. Like I said, nobody in Canada has really accepted that, so I had to content myself in the review process, because they actually did put me there, of picking and advocating for people I had never heard of with proposals that were sort of out there and had nothing to do with our department's strategy or anything like that. I'm waiting to see the results of that, but I know the results will be good. I have a lot of confidence in that. So at the very least, if you can't give the money away without conditions, I think that there should be an emphasis on trying to get away from the usual people. The other thing I had in New Brunswick, because New Brunswick's a developing area, And so we get a lot of government programs, you know, for industry startups and things like that. And this is another idea that has been universally rejected. So, is to pick an amount of money that would be reasonable for a business or enterprise startup. It doesn't have to be the full amount, because you want to encourage collaboration. And each person in New Brunswick has the right to access this once. And once they get their business development grant, that's it, they're done. because again, in New Brunswick, you see the same people, right? They start up a business, goes on for a while, and then they go for the new grant. And as long as the government money keeps coming in, the business keeps going. As soon as the government money stops, business goes under. I've seen this over and over and over, right? So if they get one grant, that's their chance. Then they're much more likely to make a go of it with this seed money that they've got. We're going to deal with enterprise systems later, so I'm not going to address that specifically right now. But I will sort of herald my remarks with the observation that I have a deep suspicion and mistrust of enterprise systems for a wide variety of reasons. And the short version of that is anything that can be less tightly connected and more distributed is going to be more robust, more scalable, and more stable than a centralized enterprise system. I have a range of arguments that support that position. That's probably good enough for a reply for this point, and I hope I've given you something to think about.
Thank you.
But I'm sure I'll touch on some of the other issues in the further comments.
Thank you very much, Steve. Any comment from any other member present today?
No one wants to clarify what you're saying there?
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that to be really careful not to stymie innovation, to be really careful not to, you know, to have this great system can lock everybody in so much that it just leaves out innovation and creativity? Is that your main issue with it?
The other two words that really scare me, common vision.
Yeah. De Bono book about that, saying that it just brings everything down to a common level rather than...
Yeah. I mean, if it's ironic because, you know, I come from the left of the political spectrum, but the bulk of the arguments I've had to make with respect to this industry, with respect to planning in general, have been based on what loosely might be called marketplace solutions. I find that really ironic. But, the common vision, the idea of a central plan, historically has been shown not to work to a large degree, and there are numerous arguments that can and do show that encouraging individual autonomy, voluntary collaboration, standards by agreement rather than by legislation, things like that, produce more innovation, are more stable, more robust, and so on.
So there's a balance there somewhere
that's struck? Well, there's a little balance. You need the network infrastructure. Otherwise, all you have is a bunch of individuals, right? But the network infrastructure has to be what I call syntactic. The people who design the internet, their point of view is the network should be stupid. The intelligence is at the ends, right? So the network, as little as possible... The network should impose constraints as little as possible. And that's what the internet does, right? The internet doesn't try to tell you what kind of content you should be sending back and forth. The internet's a pipe. But the same principle works in the organization of business and in the organization of enterprise, of governments, of things like that. If you look at a lot of the work in business literature as well, they're talking about decentralizing. They're talking about autonomous units. They're talking about companies not as centrally directed, but as networks of affiliated enterprise units, largely self-managed. And then the purpose of the company, the purpose of the central management, is to facilitate the collaboration and communication between them, but not, importantly, to tell them what to do. They can figure that out for themselves. So that's what I'm up to when I make those sorts of remarks.
Back in Adelaide, of moving in a completely different area from a budgeted annual funded cycle for a range of organisations to an agreed 3-year rolling funding, where people didn't have to do an annual budget and an annual submission for funding. And what that meant was that each individual organisation that was part of the network didn't have to spend 6 months of the year preparing a submission, and what that did then was to free them up to actually do the work that they were funded to do. And I mean, Joe and I have both been pushing for that kind of thing in the LearnScope projects in Australia without much success, because I know that it works and that it improves the quality of the work that people are doing when it happens. So keep pushing it, Stephen, because it works. It definitely works.
Before closing this one off, I'd be very interested to hear from any of the private enterprise people, because Stephen touched on that, and we are going to deal a bit with enterprise later. But what your reaction is to that comment? Here's your opportunity to tell government departments how they should be doing it.
Yeah, I was wondering whether I should just get out and leave the room now, because obviously we are in the enterprise application space, but at the same time, I think it's important that, and I'm sure it's going to get touched on later on today, is that the products like ourselves do comply with the standards like SCORM and IMS, and also have the ability to talk to other systems as easy as possible, and some of the guys here would be familiar with what we've done with the web services interface. So all we can do is try and expose our applications as much as possible, make it as easy as possible for other systems to talk to it, and also comply with standards.
So why do your products need to comply with SCORM? What's that buying you?
I think from a customer point of view, it will make it easier for the customer to pick and choose other e-learning applications. I think the days of everyone selecting one or two vendors to provide those applications are gone. And you can pick and choose not just commercial products, but also open source products that are out there.
Surely you're not saying without SCORM there would be no interoperability.
It's providing a standard for interoperability, but interoperability is easier said than done. And in reality, even with embracing something like SCORM, is that the interoperability, from our point of view, doesn't necessarily happen at a click of the button. There's still a lot of work to be done, interpretations, etc.
So it's not really buying. Anyhow, we'll come back to that.
We'll definitely come back to that.
I was just going to say that the e-learning industry here in Tasmania has just established an industry association. And we're just getting there, and that's built on that idea you were talking about of having a common structure, a focus for facilitating collaboration, but freedom to do what we do. And we were talking about, you know, how restrictive, how should it be, how shouldn't it be. So we're moving that way, and we sort of have been for a couple of years, but we're just sort of formalising some sort of structure that isn't going to be restrictive, but will allow for people to work together. Yeah.
Can you send me information on that organisation, because I'll be talking on subjects relevant to that on Monday, and it'll be useful to have that background.
Yeah, sure. Be good for us too.
Tasmania has followed the New Brunswick model for some time. I think we're still a long way behind. All right, thank you all very much. I think we might move on to the next presentation. Phil Dilger, if you would like to tell us all about LEAP.
Yeah, I would. I'm supposed to be off clear-wheeling a couple of my staff just at the moment, so I'm actually have to go to the staff meeting. Can I just pick up mine down the track?
Yes, fine. Would
that be all right? So we can just do a shuffle.
Yep.
Many of my colleagues are sitting around the table here and could actually... I won't dump it on the event just at the moment. We'll pick this up a little later.
All right, we'll move on to Jeff Ellis.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a natural follow-up.
Well, if you'd like to continue on, Greg, you're most welcome, it's up to you. Otherwise, I'll pick it up later on.
Right.
But I'll only be half an hour or so, if that's all
right. I think we'll move on with Jeff Ellis. Yeah.
Thanks,
okay, Steve.
Thank you.
It's interesting that when you're asked to talk at an event like this, you know, the human face and voice is a pretty good communication machine, and my first reaction was, I'd better do a PowerPoint, you know, to sort of improve on it. And so I've got one here, and people can look at PowerPoints afterwards, but in this environment, it's probably best just to talk. I'm with Distance Education Tasmania, and we teach all the students who are out of school for various reasons, and I guess we've moved from being a correspondence school model to just about fully online now, and we teach about 220 students directly, and now with the amalgamation, the restructuring of the department, with the amalgamation of the online school, about 1,300 students in subjects that schools might be able to offer. Those subjects are offered remotely by other schools, and we haven't moved completely away from those print models. Joe Murray's name is on some of those old units. And when a student's leaving on a boat tomorrow, it's very good to go and grab something off the shelf. But what I want to talk mainly about today, and I'll be brief, is a Centra Symposium, which is a it's a multi-party, web-based video conferencing system. And we first noticed it being used by South Australian School of the Air, and they've used it to replace their radio lessons, and we couldn't now imagine teaching without it. And 3 years ago we ran a Year 10 English Online course, and this was run completely through WebCT, and I also teach French, and I thought that what's really missing in all this, and what's missing is this oral and aural richness that goes with language teaching. It's very difficult to teach languages through a fairly reasonably static medium like WebCT. So we looked around for alternatives, and we've got an innovations grant from Imagine. Thank you, Judy. And we trialled various things. We started off just looking at net meeting, and network managers don't like that very much for security reasons. Eventually, we came up with Centra. And I guess what we were really looking to do was to try and capture that warmth and closeness that comes when you're teaching the class face to face. And is that really possible? So we sought to make online learning affordable, voice and vision communication available to all students. If you ever tried to do telephone conferencing, it's extremely expensive. I know we've done it with the National Materials Development Network around Australia, something like $300 or $400 an hour. So that was really out of the question for us. We wanted something that was inexpensive. Centra allows us to see students. It allows the teacher or the presenter has control over markup tools, and can give the students a microphone. The camera is important because, it allows us to see students for the first time. Some of these kids are travelling around Australia. I've never ever seen them. Some of them are in Thailand. We've got students in Vietnam. I've got students in Scotland. I've got students in England. And I had a student in France last year. And so some of these students I've never seen, in the real. So we can see and hear students. It's got an interactive whiteboard. It allows us to, have you ever tried to teach long division of a fraction over the telephone? It's quite difficult. with an interactive whiteboard coupled with a graphics tablet, you can write on it. That's great. You can also run videos through the whiteboard, and that's great. And so we actually have an assembly now. We had an assembly on Wednesday, and we've had up to 51 families at our assembly attending from different places around the world. And like all good assemblies, we finished with a musical item. And those of you who saw the LearnScope presentation, we had one of my students. We videoed her playing guitar, and then we sort of shrank that down to a reasonable size and in megabyte terms. And then we played that through the interactive whiteboard, and that was the musical item that closed our assembly. Low teaching is fantastic because you can actually write the script and on the whiteboard, and you can say, this is how it sounds. This is the first time that we've been able to do it. So I think it has remarkable application for language teaching. And what I found was missing too from WebCT was, there's no tone. So when you type in a joke or something, it can fall flat or go down wrong, be taken the wrong way because, there's no tone of voice. And if you've ever taught languages, you'll know that 90% of messages is tone of voice. In French, for example, they don't ask questions, they just say the statement, you're going out today. The tone of voice is totally important in conveying a message, so you can get tone of voice. We can do drama, we can video kids doing things, we can have the SRC online, the Parents Forum online, we can have show and tell, and it also has breakout rooms, so we can send students off to a breakout room and they can discuss something and come back.
the question I'd be interested in talking about, Stephen, is, you know, people say, well, it's, you know, it's not, the technology is not important, it's, you know, the curriculum behind it, the teaching ideas that are behind it that are really important, but the technology does make a difference to what you can teach and learn and how you teach and learn. And one small example, I guess, is with Centra being web-based, there's always a 3 to 5 second delay before the student hears what you're saying. And, you know, some educators will say, when you ask kids a question, you should always give them time to pause and reflect. You shouldn't just say, what's the answer? And interestingly, that pause is built in Centra, but sometimes it's up to 10 seconds because there's a big delay.
Must be deliberate.
So, you know, normally you go, good morning, John, how are you today? And what's the weather like up in Strawn? And you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and John, you know, will come back to you. So what I'm really interested in is finding out what this technology is really good at, and then finding that it's best, you know, educational application, because I think that the technology does make a difference. And in fact, there's a PhD student is coming and shadowing these lessons because she's doing her PhD entirely on the way students, you know, construct language through technology. So it's quite. I think relationships we found were really important when we were doing our English online, and this is very more easily done through video conferencing. It's sort of, so it's ELDS compliant, you know, it's communicating, building and maintaining identity and relationships, being information literate, connected, just building social capital. But I think the most important thing is looking at the technology, seeing what it's really good at, and then finding what is its most effective educational, you know, application.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Very much for time also. It did remind me of one thing. I know some people will bring along presentations or something they want to show and talk about. We're quite happy for that to be set up at lunchtime and show Stephen if he has time to have a look at it. So
okay, yeah, I've got a disc here and I've just got some videos if people are interested. But it was mainly designed for business, which is interesting. And yes, South Australia. And interestingly, one other thing I'd say is that although these ideas are developed through for the advantage of distance education students, I think their ultimate application will be in the classroom, because, you know, where you could have a gifted group, say, and they could, or any special interest group, and they could link with a group anywhere in the world. You know, if you're doing a project on South Australia, well, why not link with a school in South Australia, and they can take their video and show you how flat the land is and how hot it is and everything else. And interestingly, the South Australian government has now just bought this system for every school, so that they've seen how to, you know, they're looking to embed distance education principles, I suppose, into everyday classroom face-to-face education.
Thank you. Over to you, Stephen.
Yeah, just on the note of presentations first, if you send them to me or give me a URL, I'll link to them in my newsletter, and that way there can be some wider leadership of it.
I'm hard to bring up my own voice here. There's you know, I've developed over the years a reputation for, you know, I hear something and I criticize it like crazy. There's not a lot to criticize in what you've just said. You're obviously doing a lot of things right. You know, the sorts of questions that occurred to me, well, one, and actually if you could address this, I'm wondering what the students at the end are doing for bandwidth. How are they connecting in? Because you're talking about streaming video and that sort of stuff.
Well, we find that when we have an assembly, we have lots of, like, we have the musical item, and we might have a featured family, so we have lots of photos. And we ask the students to log on, say, you know, 20 minutes before the class starts.
Pre-downloads.
And we find that the sound is always pretty good.
Right.
Picture is not so reliable, but it's only a little picture. And then you can run the picture, you can say, hi, how are you? You can see what the student looks like. Then you can close down that application. And as long as the students don't have too much other stuff on their machine,
right,
and as long as they don't have anything else running at the same time, we find that the whiteboard and the voice is pretty reliable.
Okay, yeah. This has always been my problem with things like Centras, you know, because I'm on that, but I'm also reading my email, I'm also on the web, and things collide, and then the whole system starts to lurch. The other thing I was going to talk about a wee bit, and then you sort of did a coda at the end and talked about it, was the connecting with the other departments and that. Because it seems to me like the main thing I've always had
with products like Centra, and there are of course others, is that it sort of encourages sort of a closed institution specific or even class specific exchange of communication in these audio and video formats. And one of the things I've always tried to push is to break learning out of these individual classes and draw the connections with the other districts. So you talk about, you know, showing the flatland in South Australia. It's of course preempted my remarks. But I'm curious to know if you've been experimenting with things like Skype, which provides voice communication. It doesn't do all the other stuff, but my thinking is all the other stuff is going to come. And so that instead of a platform-specific means of delivering audio, video, and whiteboard and things like that, whether you would be able to get the same capacity, the same results, if you were using these free applications that are now coming on stream, like Skype. So, do you have any comments on Skype? Have you seen it?
I've used Skype. I get to talk to my son in Zimmer every day. Unlimited time, and I can use the message part of the writing part as well. I can use MSN Messenger, and if you're anything else, and I can send him ordinary emails and all sorts of things at the same time while easily talking.
Sure,
it's really good.
Because yeah, that's what I think, right? But all the stuff that you've described with Centra is in a very short time just going to become part of the ordinary desktop. And then the question becomes, what's Centra buying you after that?
What appealed to us about it, I guess, was like the markup tools and, you know, kids, simple things, but for little children, we teach students from, you know, kindergarten to grade 10, the fact that they can raise their hand, you know, if they want to speak. And if you've got 51 kids at an assembly, and then we'll put them in order, you know, number them in order. So you can say, right, you know, over to you, Max, you know, what would you like to say today? The kids can write on the whiteboard, and sometimes we have the naughty kids at the assembly because they use the markup tools to write on the pictures that we've got on. But the presenter can actually clear it and start again. You can put stars and ticks, you can applaud if somebody says, you know, which is a nice thing to do. If somebody makes a joke, you can have a little laughing symbol. And it's a bit clunky and simplistic, but it's the sort of things that kids actually, they use them and they show their appreciation, I guess, and by using them they show their appreciation of them.
I liked the way you drew the contrast between that mode of learning and the mode of learning typified by WebCT. It's another way I could have gone with my comments before that, but I'm sure we'll come back to that. So. But I mean, because what you're doing is demonstrating a lot of, especially what a lot of the theorists are saying, that, you know, education isn't a presentation of information. Education is a conversation and a dialogue, which your approach instantiates in WebCT, maybe less so.
If you commented, you know, about the cost of like a conference call, etc., what's the cost per student of like Centra?
Well, we bought a one-off license. I'm not sure how much that cost, but it was quite a few cents.
The cost per student is quite high.
But that gives us an unlimited time, and you know, we can roll, and we can have we've got up to 220 students at that using it directly. We wouldn't have that many because not every student has a computer, but most of our students, you know, three quarters would. So I guess, that's a one-off cost, I guess.
Yeah. How many sites would you have all at the same
time? You can have any. What the students do is that they log on to, they are given a password, you know, a username and a password, and they log on. And you can run any number of classes simultaneously. So we can have, I can have John in the next room running the Junior Science Club at the same time that I'm teaching, you know, Year 10 English or communicating.
But when you actually see, because when a student's been using Centra, how many different sites would they be actually using, say, one room in Centra at one time?
We've had up to 50 log on to our assembly. You can create an agenda. This is another thing. It's just like you prepare a lesson and you create an agenda either through URLs or through PowerPoint, and then you just log them onto the agenda and then you click on them. The advantage of PowerPoint is that the presenter has controls over them. When you've just put in URLs that it is then the student can then navigate, has to navigate themselves. Whereas if you put it in through PowerPoint, the presenter controls the navigation. But we've had up to 50 kids at once, although we find that 10 is probably like the optimum number. Yeah.
We start to look at question about the limitations of WebCT as the collaboration features. We'll be trialling that next year, I hope.
I think one of the magic things about synchronous environments, whether it's central or others, is that it's a better emulation. It enables easy emulation of good teaching, which is actually quite difficult to do asynchronously, although, you know, there's good things in having both. But can I just clarify that cost? Isn't that an annual cost? I don't think that's a forever license, is it?
We had a specialised name for it, I suppose.
And I guess what will be your comment, Stephen, about going for individual tools like Skype and so on. And I mean, Phil, I don't know how much will get touched on Phil's lead presentation, but in looking at what I guess is an enterprise-wide solution through our learning architecture project, but Tasmanian Education Department is actually, in terms of scale, you know, what in other countries would be considered, you know, a whole. We're a good size to do things as a whole area, I think. And I guess we've been very conscious in looking at communication tools, debated at length the pros and cons of integrated suites versus individual tools in terms of being able to work with things and chuck them away if a better one comes along, etc., etc. So, you know, very much in the spirit of enabling this sort of stuff, but without those huge recurrent costs.
Well,
yeah.
This is most kids, you know, believe it or not, actually like to be in school, and that's what we do, socialisation. We teach students, and they're like, sometimes they don't want to go back to school, you know, they want to go at the end of the year, so you say, well, didn't you like the program? I don't want to go to the end of the year social, you know that. Kids like to be in school, and so this has a specialist application for distance education. And I guess that there is always competition, isn't it? And new things come on the market that probably will keep the price, you know, keep the price down, I think.
Yeah. I think the challenge for us, like at system level, is to try and provide tools that can easily be put together to give you the functionality you're experiencing there, because what you're doing is fantastic. But that ongoing cost, is, you know, and it is desirable to have it in ordinary classrooms, but totally unaffordable, which is why we need to look at other solutions.
That you can't hope to catch more than 5 to 15% of the audience, something like that, on any particular product, because you're either a personal preference or a teaching preference or whatever, and you'll find it difficult to do a whole enterprise system full stop. And so I think part of our learning architecture project is doing some infrastructure items that, yes, they can go off and do their own thing if they've got the skills, and we're not stopping that. We may not be helping them a great deal in some areas, but if we produce the enterprise glue for some of these things, they can go off and connect using you know, whatever systems they can, and still have that innovative role. But we can still provide some background support for the schools that can't do their own stuff, maybe.
Okay.
I'll put it here so it's clearly recorded, because this is the industry wanting to have it both ways, right? Because on the one hand, we've got all of this talk about standards and interoperability so that different systems can work together. And on the other hand, we have all of this talk about enterprise in order to get, because the different systems don't work together, right? And, I mean, what's the problem really with the audio-video applications? My experience is the one audio system won't talk to another audio system, right? The codecs, the things like that are incompatible. So, you know, if I'm sitting there with the two-way voice tool by Microsoft, say I can't call up a two-way voice tool by some other producer. Instant messaging is the classic example of that, right? It's instant messaging is a beautiful, brilliant tool. We've got ICQ. We've got AOL Instant Messenger. We've got MSN Messenger. They don't talk to each other, right? And, you know, there's all this talk about standards, but none of these standards are addressed at communication. And it's the remark that I made earlier about standards should apply at the syntactic level. The industry almost systematically has ignored standards at the syntactic level. And the standards that we're getting, learning object metadata and all of that, are standards at the semantic level. Standards talking about the content that we send through the pipe rather than the structure of the pipe. So enterprise systems wouldn't be necessary if the people who are in the industry actually had some commitment to interoperability. And, you know, people say, yeah, you have to have an enterprise system because these things don't interact. Well, yeah, but the people who are making these things are the ones who made it the case that they don't interact. And this is a big part of my advocacy of free and open source software, is because the standards are open and these things can interact. And so, you know, I have something like Skype. Right now, Skype is Skype, but the thing with Skype is people know how it works. And so, you know, it's not going to be long before we have Skype, and we have Fred Skype, and Skype Fork 2, and so on and so forth. And that interaction, that interoperability can happen. So, I lose patience with it, right? I lose patience with the advocacy of enterprise systems, because that advocacy is based on a fundamentally dysfunctional model of software, and I get frustrated with the advocacy of standards because the standards are never actually created in the places where we actually need them. So that's enterprise, and I could go on about that, but that's enterprise.
Yeah, but I can also talk about, you know, universities we sell to that have gone open source maybe, you know, 3 years ago, and 3 years down the track they still haven't got a deliverable system. So there's also a reality check that you've got to put in these open source solutions that are they really delivering in that space?
Well, I mean, the argument that comes from the commercial side is always that sort of argument, right? Yeah, your open source community is just not in a position to be able to create the software, doesn't have the developers, doesn't have the coordination, doesn't have the market testing, and so on. And that, really, if you want robust systems, they have to come from the commercial sector. And I sit there and say, fine, give us the kind of systems that we need to use then, rather than the kind of systems designed to milk money from especially public systems. Right? The colleges and the universities and the school departments are, you know, if they want this kind of interactivity, are almost forced to pay, you know, these huge annual fees for technology that, you know, and I know actually costs a lot less than that. And it's because this openness isn't here. So, I mean, half the problem that, you know, the open source hasn't produced a viable solution is because so much of the software that these solutions have to interact with, like Windows, is closed and proprietary. So, I mean, the big problem with open source is, to a large degree, the commercial software industry. So I'm sort of saying, you know, like, stop accusing the other people of the problems you're creating in order to build a viable business model. Right? You want to talk interoperability? Let's talk instant messaging. Let's talk voice communication. Let's talk a common whiteboard standard. I mean, that's the kind of interoperability. And IMS and SCORM and all of these things have completely ignored the kind of interoperability that would actually make a difference. It just kills me.
High rate over.
We might call a halt to that one. But thank you all very much. You're all very passionate about that. It's really an interesting topic. And if by the end of the day we have a bit of time, I might bring up a little bit more about that.
You see what happens when you have me talking off the cuff with those folks?
That's why we wanted you here. Thank you very much, Stephen. All right. With your permission, Phil, we might move back to you.
Yeah, we'll try and take very long.
I'm far too emotional for that stuff. I'm not quite sure what we want to look at today, but what I've done is actually printed off a case study just for your own information to take away with you. The case study that's just recently been done on our project with the Ministerial Council Task, ICT Task Force. It's the publisher at the moment, so you'll get a nice copy, coloured copy one within a week or so, but at the moment, that one. Basically, the Learning Architecture Project is really an acknowledgement and from the department in relation to ICT and teaching and learning in our compulsory schools. As Janine alluded to earlier on, we've got 218 schools across the state that we work for, and 70,000 kids in those schools. So we could, in fact, be quite a neat little district in some other jurisdictions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but the Learning Architecture Project is looking at teaching and learning and the aspects of teaching and learning, and we've broken our project up into the sort of plan, deliver, assess, report sort of components and the sorts of things that one needs to be able to do that. Understanding also that Tasmania at the moment is in the middle of the implementation of new curriculum framework as well, the essential learning, and with that framework comes a whole lot of sort of pedagogical sort of initiatives as well, and what we're trying to do with our project is also support those, so the ability for student-student communication, teacher-student communication, teacher-teacher communication, and the collaboration that goes on across all those sorts of teaching and learning activities, and the planning where teachers are working together to plan learning sequences, where teachers are working together in the delivery for two students, so multiple teachers to a student, multiple teachers to multiple students, etc., etc. And then when it comes to the assessment and the reporting side, having that same sort of collaborative environment for teachers to submit and work and concur together on student judgment, judgments about student work, etc., and then the production of reporting out from that. So out of that and around the table, I'll invite many of my colleagues here. Chris, who's an IT consultant on the team. Greg, who's the technical architect on the team as well. Enterprise. On the dark side, he's wearing the black. And Janine, who's one of our project managers, and Penny, who's one of the project leaders of various areas. And I suppose one of the key aspects of this particular ICT project is, and as Bill referred to in his presentation, is the way in which it's been structured, that it in fact is not something that's coming out of the IT area and imposing onto schools, but in fact is looking from the other side. It's working across business units within the department who have a particular need for ICT in their area. So we're working with the curriculum people. We work with the State Library because of their knowledge and what have you about storage and metadataing and retrieval and searching and tapping into the knowledge that we have across our department in all sort of aspects. So we have a steering committee that actually has the directors of those partners, so the people who in fact are able to make the decisions that happen lower are part of our project and are in fact the part of the key. Picked up a bit earlier and you talked about the innovation. I suppose that's sometimes one of the key tensions at the time we have in the project that we have, and you set the funding and you set your project details and you move down that particular track and try to deal with that sort of innovation that comes along the line. So one of our challenges is still remaining flexible to be able to incorporate that, to allow others to incorporate that into what they're doing. But I think one of the key aspects too is to actually have the people with the flexible and the ideas and the thinking as part of the team that's actually working as well. So often the products that we're actually working with at the moment are in fact stretching the business unit's idea about what this might be. When you sit down with a client and say, well, what are we doing? How are we scoped this out? Where are we working in this area? They come with a vision of this size, and I think one of the important aspects of the project that we've gathered around a group whose vision is bigger than that, and not necessarily shared, because there's often considerable tension in the group, but where the innovation is actually now starting to stretch the end user. It may not be taken up in the first instance, but it's there, it's available for people to actually start to move on. So hopefully we're trying to pick up the early adopters and the early innovators and work within, yet still catering for the person who is just entering the environment. So it's one of our key challenges.
Actually learn something about what's working, what's
what we need to do.
Absolutely.
Not spend enough money, but next year we can't throw it away and start again.
That's right.
I think, you know, the big thing about the enterprise stuff is if you spend millions of dollars on an enterprise solution and you believe everybody's going to use it, you're wrong,
and then you won't admit you're wrong because you've had to, you know, cast off those millions of dollars in order to do it.
I suppose that's one of the key things at Greek Voyage, the project, is the iterative development that we're under. So we deal with little bits, and we show that little bit, and we work on that.
And there may only be 80% functional, but the main points, and we move on in another iteration.
And we also have at the table here one of our project partners that we work with, a developer who we actually share the product. We provide IP, they build the product, they take the IP and commercialise that product. So those sorts of arrangements, I think, are really important and key in this the development of this.
Actually, it's stuff that we're doing is in niches rather than trying to cover a whole range of things that you just drop into an organization and say you can go to the management. And those niches overlap as well. So this year in the collaboration and communication area, so it's just wherever you put a mark and say you're going to do something, there's no spot that overlaps like 30% like that, which is quite neat.
And one of the keys, I suppose, was that last year was our first year of our project. We were able to actually build the base components of what we're actually doing, working on. So opportunities for planning the assessment reporting area. We already have in place identity management systems and what have you. But building up services and modules and what have you, that now this year we're moving into the production of digital portfolio, which in fact pulls out various bits and pieces from all these other things and starts to glue them together and create new sort of functionality from existing components. And that's, I suppose, one of the key sort of aspects of where we're going with this particular area. There's just a quick opportunity under the plan area. We've developed the Learning Edge tool, which is providing the online planning collaboration between teachers, delivery, a very simple delivery tool out to students as well in that area. Moving that into the delivery, looking at LMS, but not LMS as a whole thing, but looking at our components now, where we've reached and saying, well, what are the things that we have already have that are going to provide for the delivery of these items across to students from the very early years of learning through to our Year 12 students as well. We're looking at opportunities for teacher space, student space, for access to resources, for access to applications and things, so that the environment for teachers is one that is relatively simple for them to actually enter and get engagement, as opposed to where we may come from, where these things are in fact across a whole multitude of places, and those with the knowledge could actually get in and do stuff. Those that were entering in and didn't have the knowledge found there were barriers because of just the simple sort of location and variety and breadth of things that they're trying to deal with. So we're bringing in those things into providing access points for both staff and students.
Philip, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. Good. Whether you want to close something on.
No, I don't know whether there's... I think we've actually used the... we stick with the project management sort of capacity. I think that's provided us with a great support for the way in which we work. But as I say, I think the key aspect is bringing in of our clients into the project themselves and having people work across the project. So we're meeting our user needs as opposed to it being purely an IT implementation across the project.
Very good. Thank you. I'd just like to say to you all again, please help yourself to tea or coffee or water as we progress, because I wasn't going to break before lunch unless you deem that totally necessary. Stephen's very concerned where you're all going to get tea and coffee from, because he believes that's only just enough for him over there. So I see that the first person made a move and Stephen was right behind him.
Team my coffee.
So the lunch break, that'd be what, 11:20?
We've got a ways to go, yes.
Okay, and I realized as I was sitting here thinking that there was actually no place that I could go for coffee without interrupting sort of part of the proceedings.
It's much nicer sort of being at the edge of something like this, because then you can sneak out and nobody notices. My life has always depended on being able to sneak out of meeting. There's a few things here I want to highlight. One of the important things, and like,
trying to find something
out of that. No, there's a lot that's good here, and I want to be clear about that. There's a lot going on that is worthwhile. In particular, the incremental development, the incremental rollout, rather than dropping a major system on people and say, here, learn this. It only took us 4 years to develop, but you got the next couple of days to figure this out. I've always thought that Windows should be designed that way. You buy a new computer, right, and it has to have an operating system, otherwise it's a piece of metal and plastic. But when you buy the system, it would actually have, you know, like very minimal components on it, and you know, like it would do what you are capable of understanding at that point if you're a new computer user, right? So, you know, it would access the internet and maybe take you to a start site or a portal, right? It would give you an easy interface for email, right? You just type in your email address and your message, and that's pretty much the extent of it. The word processor would, like, accept words and maybe print them. And then as you grew more familiar, And that's not simply all that would be presented to you. That, quite literally, is all that would be on the computer. So that you'd have a startup time of like half a second. Remember when computers started when you turned them on? People today, you know, younger people today don't realize that, you know, back in my day, back in aught, whatever, your computer, you'd turn it on, it would start. It was ready to go. That really happened. And then as you used your Windows would acquire more capacity depending on what you wanted to do. And ultimately, every iteration of Windows would actually be different, because people want to do different things with their computers. So the iteration is really important, because people aren't ready to, and never will be ready to just launch into this stuff in the first place. I get shown stuff a lot, you know, a new software, a new website, whatever, and I can't count the number of times I've looked at the software or the website and sort of said, okay, what does it do? I sit here and try to think about this for a minute. What does this stuff do? And I have no idea. And I realize, oh, geez, you know. So, you know, to me, any software that requires training is broken. If you have to take a training course, if you have to read a manual, it hasn't been properly designed. And the incremental rollout is the way to approach that. But the incremental rollout has to be not just the way the software is being introduced to the enterprise. It has to be the way the software introduces itself to new users. Because as time goes by, there will be new staff coming on. And they're faced with the same hurdles. On the one hand, I think that consulting and getting the input from users is incredibly important. Your computer has just locked itself. It must be XP. On the other hand, there's a danger here. And I've seen this danger in a variety of circumstances whereby you get your user base together and you try to find out what their requirements are. Well, their requirements are exactly whatever will entrench their current position. And consequently, for example, a major contributor
and people are probably not going to like me for this, but a major contributor is the librarians. Well, if there's any position that's under siege from the internet, it's that of the librarian. And just to be clear, before I get assassinated, I'm not saying that the librarian...
We're all standing against that behind that gun with you.
Yeah. It's not to say that the librarian has suddenly become useless, and the opposite is the case, but the function of the job with new technology changes so dramatically, it hardly resembles what it was. And the flip side is, with the job changing so dramatically, I would expect a corresponding increase in salary. But the thing is, a lot of librarians don't see that, and a lot of librarians see a system like this as, okay, how can I collect, store, and manage a collection of information resources? But this is the age of the internet, and the age of the internet is an age where information isn't static lumps of stuff like that anymore, where it becomes dynamic and movable, doesn't matter where it's located, and so on and so forth. So if you build in the requirements of the librarian into the system without a very careful critical appraisal of the affordances of the system as compared to the affordances of books, paper, floors, and so on, then there's a danger there of the system locking you in and not allowing you to be able to move forward. I have a third comment, which I'll keep brief. It sort of goes back to this whole enterprise thing again, because in the previous bit I was like in slam mode. So, but anybody can criticize, but what's the positive on the other side, right? And the positive on the other side is, because there's nothing inherently wrong with building an enterprise system if, as you said, it can be replaced, right? There's nothing inherently wrong with building an enterprise system if you can take a piece out of that and put in a different piece, right? You know, everybody talked about learning objects as discoverable, reusable, interoperable. Nobody talked about software that way. Well, a few people do, but, you know, mostly, you know, you say something like that, people say, yeah, componentization, we tried that, didn't work. That's why we're doing enterprise. I figure, I have these little standards by which I judge everything because I'm very judgmental, but I figure if I can't replace part of the enterprise system that I think isn't working for me with software that I can write on Notepad, if I can't, or WordPad, because Notepad is limited length, it might be long software, but if I can't replace that piece with something I wrote in Perl or PHP or even C, but that's pushing it because it's compiled, right? If I can't replace it with software that I wrote myself, it's broken. It shouldn't be used. If I don't know how the pieces communicate with each other, if that's some sort of deep, dark secret, so I can't pull out a piece and replace it, it's broken. If I cannot write a piece of software completely independently of your system that allows me to interoperate and interact with appropriate permissions, I'm not talking about like being able to write software that will allow me to hack into your system at will, that would just make you Microsoft. but I need to have the capacity to interoperate. And so, like, some people were talking to me about this yesterday, and the first question I asked was, well, could I get a feed of the learning resources that you have, say, in RSS, and say in RSS. It doesn't have to be in RSS. I'm multilingual on XML. You know, I do RSS. I do Dublin Core. I'll do IEEE LOM if I have to. I don't care. Because it's known. And if it's known, I can code for it. But can I code something like that that takes a learning resource that's sitting there in your system and that I could put a link to it in a wiki on my system and it works? And the answer right now, I think, is no. The answer is no, partially because it doesn't work in such a way as to allow external access to resources. And the answer is no, partially because
The resources come in the form of things like IMS content packages, and you can't link to them because they're zipped, which means no browser in the world can read them.
So you're wrong on all those counts.
Okay, then correct me. Correct me.
We have an open interface.
Open interface. Publish.
We publish it to the people who are our friends. Yes.
See, that's not what you call an open interface. It's an open interface if your enemies can use it.
Okay, we're not frightened about publishing it. Okay, we're just unpublishing it at the moment.
Right.
Okay, in the sort of design of packages, when you take them away in IMS packages, they're stored in whatever form that's deliverable through a URL at this point.
Right.
So you've got that flexibility. So, sort of.
So the potential is there, and you will actually at some point tell people about this.
Yeah, probably. This is not maybe, because some of this is about the value of the gear that you have, and some of our Australian education systems haven't actually been very good swapping it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, seeing it as an intellectual property exercise that they won't give away for free. So if we had the other states saying, we'll swap you our stuff, I'm sure that we'd come to the party and swap our stuff as well. And they don't do it.
So you're not going to open source because they won't?
No. The only reason we have is that we're at the early stage of that development, I think. And we'll get it right for ourselves,
sure.
Which is where we're at now.
And we are
willing
to use open source, aren't we?
Yeah, open source for components of our systems anyway. And it's not an open source of Microsoft decision at any point. It's about what's going to work for us, you know, for our business. Whatever model of the process is, I think. We get some very good deals from Microsoft, and that's. Makes it easier to cheaper, or almost as cheap as buying free software, because we have an enterprise that just pays the stuff and we can churn it through.
Well, Microsoft provides free stuff for you, so that the people who work with you have to buy Microsoft. It may be cheap for you, but Microsoft isn't giving it away if it's not creating an advantage for itself.
Exactly right.
That's good. Okay, I mean, what you're saying is good, and I'm glad to hear it. To a point, I mean, I haven't gone into the discussion about IP yet, and people think IP is actually going to be worth money, and it's again the dollar sign to people's eyes, but I haven't seen yet the college or university really like ring the big bell with IP for stuff like this. Maybe the one exception might be WebCT, but that wasn't even a college or university project. That was just like Murray working on his own, and he kind of took off.
I think in what you're saying there about reuse, we haven't actually allowed the outside world to reuse.
Right.
But one of the big things from our stuff, we actually use their product, which is covers a few areas of the. Of the spectrum. And what we actually do then, because we have the interfaces published to drag the information out and present it, we actually preparing controls that put a little bit of business logic around what goes on in our repository.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, well, okay, if you want to present information about Aboriginal health, put the control on the page, configure it up, and it'll bring repository stuff out, which gives some feedback. So it's good for them to put their information in the repository in the first place,
right.
And then they can reuse it. And it's the one control, and you can change the look and feel. It's all style sheeted and configurable, and you can put that on any page. And our strategy is sort of about that we have these controls that may take one or more sources of information, put some basic business around it, but then let it wild, so that people can use it as they choose, so that the information can get around as widely as possible.
Okay, I'd have to look in detail at those controls, obviously, because it's one of the major issues right now in our field is the. And it's even one of the topics for later on, digital rights, access to material, control of the use of material, so on and so forth. And as I'm sure you know, there were various attempts by various companies to make DRM something proprietary to their systems. There are other attempts to push for something that's more open in the form of DRM.
And by DRM, I'm talking about not so much commercialization of software, but just simply associating the rights associated with an object with the object itself, so that the object can go out there and travel the world, and it doesn't suddenly become used in the ways that authors don't want it to be used. Now, my preference is, you know, just put it out in the world and let it make its own life, and, you know, cut the strings. But not everybody thinks that way about objects and resources, and I understand that. So, and the trick is to allow the people who have resources that they want in some way to control the use of, to have that control without thereby requiring that the entire network instantiate the mechanisms required in order to make that control possible. That's the tricky part. That's why I have to see what you've done in detail to see how well you meet that objective or not. And the design so far suggests to me that you've at least come part way, and you may have come all the way, but I don't know. I can't say. Sure. But I mean, like, I'll know more when you send me the APIs or something like that, and I try to code something up in Perl or PHP that will grab a resource, because, you know, nothing personal. I don't want to use your system. Many people may. I don't. And I don't because I like coding my own stuff, because then I can do stuff I want. I don't because I've already got 3 or 4 systems on my computer now, and I don't really want another one. You know what I mean? And,
you might have to call up to that one there, guys. Right. Stephen's challenge. Stephen's asked you to send the APIs. And away you go. You'll get some answers. We'll move on to Frankie Forsyth. Thank you, Frankie.
Thanks, guys. What I'd like to do is turn it around a little bit, because Jill, who's my business partner, she's going to access a website that I'd like to show and have commented on, if that's okay. While Jill's doing that, what I'd like to do is to give my questions to Stephen first, if I may. If I can give you my questions first and then do a bit of blurb, and then that way you have some thinking time on the questions as well.
Yeah? Thinking time doesn't always help.
That's true.
Elizabeth Todd will be the person then. Elsewhere. Carol, do you
Okay, who knows Elizabeth's password? Everyone who knows
it could be blank.
It could be password. Help me, keystrokes here.
Great. Okay, so the questions are the areas that I'd love you to...
O-L-L-I-N-G-W-O-O. No.
Not quite. Okay, so what I'd really like to do is to not talk an awful lot myself, but to ask you some questions, because I value your time more than my talking. In one of your old dailies, you made some comments about private RTOs, and I'd like you to just talk around private organizations and how you see them fitting into the learning world. That's just one question.
Just tell me what you mean by ITO, because
RTO is Registered Training
Organization. Oh, RTO, okay.
So you were talking about like private training organizations, right, rather than public ones, and I guess the philosophies behind them too. Yeah. I guess where that comes from is that we are a private RTO, but we don't see ourselves as a money making. We make money to survive, but we don't sort of, we're not into it for that primary purpose. The second question I wanted to ask you about was that what do you see as the future regarding some structures which would enable organizations who want to support individuals' learning to do so without building these huge learning management systems? And I'm thinking here about the use of, you know, the RSS feeds, the use of individual searches, the use of guided learning frameworks. So I'd like to hear your ideas and your thoughts on some of that stuff, and whether you've seen anything happening in that area. I'm also passionate, after a very short time frame, about the open source movement, but what I've found is that the new technology options are bewildering, and for some of us who are non-technologists, trying to keep up with the new technologies can be difficult, and it's certainly time-consuming. It's also great fun, and I've spend a lot of happy time looking at it. But are there any sort of systems or structures or mechanisms whereby people around the world that you've seen can if you like, simplify and access and share this information without having to spend huge amounts of time learning new things that are coming out. So, for example, like what I mean by that is, like, I find Old Daily really fabulous because you give me the information to go and look at different things. Is there something else like that that's accessible to people that we can then build on and I can share with my people that I work with? The last question, if I may, as far as question goes, second last, I'm greedy, is that you talked about Moodle, about Skype, and I've been searching for some time for a relatively inexpensive voice VoIP that also has whiteboard and web browsing, and or something that will work with Skype to do web browsing or whiteboard, and I'd be interested to know if you've got any thoughts or ideas on what could be of use with that. And then finally, what we've done is I've put up on the board, on the screen, we've been playing in Moodle to allow other organizations who've not got up to speed yet with learning management systems or with doing things on the internet to come in and play. And Joe and I would be very interested in just some sort of out and out comments on what we've done so far, given that we've only had it up for what, a month? Yep. And also we want to talk about doing things like having RSS feeds come in there and whether there's a voice protocol that we can use that we can link into something like the Moodle to make the interface a bit more easy. So those are my questions. And I'll now, if I may, just give you a 2-minute blurb on, if you like, philosophy and where we've come from. Yep, okay. So Stephen, in terms of where we've come from, and for everybody else, basically Pillion Consulting is a micro RT registered training organisation. There's only Joe and myself, and we wanted to do things well. We wanted to do things fast, and we wanted to do things efficiently, having both come out of very much more of a professional development background. So initially, when we started off, we actually managed to get into and to access the education department site, which was then WebCT. And I thought that was a fabulous way of getting small and private RTOs in to use systems, because it was the first time that I'd ever heard of a department actually saying to the private sector, come in and use this facility. And that was what got us started. So from then on, for the next, 3 to 4 years, what we basically did was, anytime we did any work with clients, and our clients have gone from being straight-out students, direct students, to small registered training organizations and components of large training organizations who've come to us and said, look, we like what you're doing. Come and tell us what you're doing and why, because the methodology we were using was very much the stuff that's close to your heart, I believe, which was the just-in-time. We would assist them to find stuff. We would give them some resources. We would support them with their questioning. And then they had to go away and do it. And then we'd come back and we'd talk through what had been done and then move them forward from there. So it was a very individualized setup. So we moved away. Now, laterally, we've gone from direct hands-on with students to working with other organizational providers to support them in getting online. And what we did was, we tended not to create our own learning management system, but what we did was we would use our clients. So we've used WebCT, we've used Blackboard, we've used Janison, we've used the whole works of them. Now we're at the stage where we're saying, okay, we don't want a huge system, but we do want to have something that we can pull things from here, pull it from there, and to be able to show to our clients, here's a whole range of different things. And over the last year, because I knew nothing about open source until last year, that's what I've been working on with flexible learning leaders, is let's look at Skype, let's look at Amplify, let's look at all these little tools and pull them together and see how they can fit. Now, I've had been funded to have time to do that, but my clients don't. So giving them some sort of some sort of hand or something to work off is the idea behind having the Moodle site where they can come in and play and access some tools. Having said that, we don't want to recreate the wheel. I'm talking too much, so I'll shut up and say it. We don't want to recreate the wheel, so I'm much more interested in linking to other places where people have things already set up. So that's where we're up to. So, Georgia, do you want to add anything on to that in terms of the question on the site?
I guess some comments on like that business model would be interesting. you know, like trying to find ways to build networks with like-minded people.
Because what we've done is rather than register to deliver courses, we will link up with other organisations who are already registered and do action arrangements. So we're very fluid and flexible. When we do that, we work with someone and then we move on, work with somebody else, we move on, depending on what we want.
Thanks, Frankie and Jess.
Yeah. In response to your comment, begin by creating life and then move on by solving world peace. After that, I'll outline the unified field theorem. there's a lot of stuff in here, and I could go on about this for a couple of days. RTOs. There are going to be specifics of the RTO system here in Australia that I don't know, but I encountered them. Actually, it's one of the outcomes of my trip here was to encounter quite a number of people who are from RTOs directly and get their perspective, because they don't always share their perspective. So it's good to hear that. So I'll begin with the message you don't want to hear. And this is not going to be a surprise to you. I'm a supporter of public education. And I'm a supporter of public education because when the provision of education becomes the responsibility of something other than that which represents society as a whole, then the needs of whatever sector it is that's providing this education become a part of the education itself. And we've seen this through history, where a certain group or segment of society is assigned control for education, and then education becomes a means of propagating the interests of that certain sector or segment of society. So education must, in my mind, and should be subjected to the needs and the interests of the public as a whole. To me, that's non-negotiable. You don't get away from that. I would argue against assigning control of education to individual religious groups. I would argue against assigning it to the Loyal Order of the Eagles or the Lions Club. I would argue against assigning it to corporations, Disney or Microsoft. Imagine, think for yourself what Microsoft education would look like. And I would argue, or worse, Disney education. The history of the world. Well, there were once this nice, warm, and fuzzy people called the Barbarians. And they liked mice. And they had a happy, peaceful existence with the people around them, except when they killed them. Disney education. And so the same sort of things are raised as a concern with RTOs. So,
RTO, the government audited organisation, so TAFEs are RTO. The education department
is an RTO.
Everybody's an RTO.
Well, if everybody's an RTO, then the distinction is meaningless. I mean, I think there's a difference between TAFE and you guys.
We're governed by the same.
Right.
The RTO status, though, is to do with funding models and how you'll be funded. And as well as that, although we're saying everyone's RTOs, they're not, because there are definitely private education sectors that don't ever register and deliver management training and a whole range of other things.
I'm just trying to understand where you're coming from. We're a non-profit community
education. Yeah, I know you're non-profit, but that just means that your objectives are different, but that doesn't... Well, I could do...
I don't understand.
It seems to me talking about structured systems,
I'm sorry, say that again.
It seems to me you're talking about a broadly available system as distinct from what an enterprise might need to do to carry out its business.
Right.
Are you saying that that should always be in the public good, sir?
Well, look. One of the major advances of the 20th century was the provision of free public education, right? And I consider that the extension of that on a global scale, and the extension of that from the primary system through to the post-secondary system, that will be, all other things being equal, the primary achievement of the 21st century. And therefore, I raise concerns about models for the distribution, the production and distribution of education or learning, and we can play around with that definition all you like, and I've been talking about what I mean by that. I'm talking about that intimate detail, what I think that that entails, but I'll just use an umbrella term for now. But if we set ourselves up into a situation where the provision of education, broadly construed, as a free public system becomes impossible because of the structure and business model that we've adopted, then we're blocking ourselves structurally from what ought to be our most significant attainment. Now, there are all kinds of reasons why I advocate for free public education for all. And we can go into that if that's where you want to go. With the mechanism, the specific issue here is, are we putting into place the system that would, in time, allow that?
Yeah.
Okay? And if there are components of the system which, A, are necessary for the system, but B, cannot continue to operate without charging fees, then we've built in this structural disincentive to free and open education. And moreover, if these, and the thing is, too, these components, insofar as they exist, have as an interest their self-existence, their continued existence, right? And if we're in a situation where these components not only are necessary for the system, but become part of what may be a loose or more formal, who knows, lobbying, advocacy, policy network that actually pushes for policy that would limit free and open education, then we have an even greater problem. Because it's the question of the mixed public and private system, right? And the mixed, in the case of the mixed public and private system, the private system, agitating for its own existence, lobbies actively against the allocation of resources to the public system. We have that, I think, in Canada in healthcare. For the large bulk of it, we have what we call single provider healthcare. And the Canada healthcare system is a single entity. We don't have private hospitals and things like that. Although around the edges, because especially, you know, we have a very corporate system south of the border, so around the edges of our system there's a lot of nibbling. And one of the areas of nibbling that happens is in the area of MRI clinics. And MRIs are very expensive, right? And so in a number of provinces, before MRIs became part of what would be considered core services, a number of private clinics were set up. And, you know, they charge you something like, I don't know what it is, $2,000 or something for an MRI. It's ridiculous. And so, you know, well, need MRIs, let's get these into the public system. But the private MRI clinics are in there lobbying, don't put them in the hospitals, they're competition. And the provision of a free public service becomes competition. in the newspaper today in Denmark there is legislation prohibiting a municipal government or any government from creating, deploying internet access. There's a city in Denmark wanted to create a broadband wireless network in its city for everyone to use. But private enterprise is the mechanism for the delivery of internet services that was chosen in Denmark. And private enterprise says, no, you can't do it. Now, all private enterprise will provide is telephone lines because that's where the profit is. Right? So it becomes a balance between the long-term and even sometimes the short-term interests of society as a whole and the interests of the particular segment that is providing this service from the private perspective. And they will be in conflict. That is inevitable. So, if a service is deemed to be essential to the public interest, then it is essential to the public interest that the distribution of this be a public enterprise. That is my argument with respect to RTOs. Now, there's a bit of a flip side. Because it doesn't necessarily mean being controlled by the minister sitting at his desk. Okay? So we need to balance out, okay, it's in the public, it has to be controlled as a public enterprise, but we need to be very aware that the mechanisms of determining what is a public enterprise and how we manage a public enterprise, those mechanisms themselves are also deficient. Because the private sector has a very legitimate thing, a very legitimate set of issues. When they talk about the need for choice, they talk about the need for diversity of services, so on and so forth. When they talk about things like inefficiency of centrally run administrations, these are all legitimate things. These are not things that argue that things should therefore be run by the private sector, but they are things that argue to the effect that the public sector should be restructured in order to become a more distributed, more decentralized, what I would call more of a network operation than a command and control operation. In the government of public enterprise, I argue for as much decentralization as possible, but the key here is decentralization does not mean sell-off. And that's the distinction that people don't draw. So that's one of your issues.
That's good, thank you.
And we're going to come back to LMS versus RSS. We're going to come back to open source. Neat idea. Skype as the input for a voice interface with Moodle. That is a neat idea. Whoops.
So can it be done?
Okay, so the really neat idea that you came up with, this is for the purpose of the tape, is using Skype as a voice interface for something like Moodle. Can it be done now? No. Because what we're lacking, at least to my knowledge, is the open source speech recognition software. Can it be done in theory? Absolutely. Will it be done? It's such a good idea, it can't not be done. That one's right up there with good ideas. If we could use Skype as voice activation for other open source software, that's huge. So that was mainly what I wanted to say on that, was that that's a keeper. Business model, trying to find networks with like-minded people, is the business model these days. It's just the network, or sometimes called the cluster model of business development. You see that a lot. You see it in New Brunswick. You see it, most importantly, in Silicon Valley. Mm.
Do you see it much between the public and the private sectors? I mean, the reason I ask this is that if I take us back, to when FES was involved, in the public sector, they opened their arms and said, look, you know, this is a new area. Private sector, we want to hear your input because you're doing things differently from us. Come in, use our system, give us feedback, be part of things like the infrastructure projects, be part of things like the digital rights movement, be part of projects. And now that seems to have moved away a little bit and closed off as people become more proprietorial about their territories. And I think that that's a backward step. You know, having come, my heart's in the public sector, even though my work is in the private sector. So, yeah.
I mean, not everybody in a society has to work for government. That would be ridiculous. you know, but let's reframe this, okay? Because when people say private sector involvement, what they mean is a person working for a company has two voices, two channels of influence. One, as a citizen of whatever entity that they live in, and a separate as this thing, which is a corporation or a company, that also gets a voice, right? And so when people talk private sector involvement, what they mean is a special place for people who have companies and everybody else, they have to go through the usual channel and try to lobby their MP. Right? So, I'm way for involvement. I'm way for the provision, like the business center that you described and all of that. I'm completely in favor of the provision of those sorts of initiatives. And I think they're important and essential. Because one of the things that government does is as a facilitator to get things off the ground, to provide the infrastructure and resources that people may not have themselves. You know, all of that falls in my books under the heading of equality of opportunity, right? But to limit it to companies is ridiculous, right? Why can't my brother come and do this thing? You know, just because he doesn't want to make money out of the enterprise doesn't matter, right? You know, why set it up as something special called private sector? It shouldn't be called private sector partnerships. It should be called citizen partnerships. And the private sector, as companies, qua companies, should not have special channels, because they're just people. They're people who are trying to get a little bit of privilege by casting themselves under a certain light. People should have influence in government. Unequivocal on that. But people should not have special privileges in government. And so you see the balance I try to draw here. All this private sector involvement that people talk about is inherently good. And I want to see it. I just don't want it restricted to the private sector.
Very good.
Any other questions on that one before we move on?
Just some comment. We're running out of time, are we? Just some quick comments on Moodle in terms of, like, this is a sort of a mechanism to get other people coming in and playing and testing and then going off and doing their own thing, for example. And it gets back to that question I asked about what sort of structures or systems there were to enable people who are wanting to go down the open source movement to do so more easily or simply. Have you got any models for us that we can learn from here?
Well, that's a harder question. I mean, open source isn't ready for prime time. Mm. I'll say that right now. I'm going to say it openly and bluntly. It's in development. It's been in development for a number of years, but I mean, it's not a viable desktop yet. But it's viable for me.
Mm.
Worked great for me. It's actually viable for my wife as long as somebody's set it up and it's ready to go. And you know, like if she was able to buy Linux out of the box from the computer store the way she can buy Microsoft now, it'd work for her. It's maybe a little less viable for my mother, right? Who's going to have less of a comfort level with computer systems. It's getting there, but right now there isn't a straightforward answer to the question. I have to think about that more and think about the sorts of things. OL Daily, the reason why I did OL Daily is to provide that entry point, that access point. But you know, there's nothing special about me. You could do one too. You could do one too. The way it's supposed to work is anybody who has the interest and inclination should do that. and then we have multiple access points. Because, you know, I mean, some of the people already in this room are thinking, oh, El Daily, yeah, it's a nice resource, but, you know, look at the politics that comes with it. Or maybe not politics. You know, look at, you know, you got all this baggage with it, you know. Oh, El Daily, great resource, but I have to listen to Stephen Downs, you know. But the idea is, like, let's have many of these. So, you know, to me, the entry point is things like blogging, RSS. But to me, the entry point, most importantly, is people in the know recording, taking down their thoughts, and making them public. I look around this room and say, why isn't anyone blogging this? You know? This is like online education. These are the people in online education. Where are the computers? Is there anyone using a computer here besides me?
I brought it. And then nobody else had one, and I got scared. I was going to do it.
So all kinds of people taking notes.
Yeah.
None of these notes are going to go beyond your notebook.
But actually, you know what, Stephen? When I came in here, and you said you were going to record it, I relaxed, truthfully, and I thought, that's okay, you're covering it.
Yeah.
You know? I can listen. That's probably more valuable for me to listen than to be playing.
But what happens, and that's good, and that's fine, but what happens at the next meeting that you're at where it's not one with me?
Yeah, then I would bring that out.
Right.
Guys, support me here. I have done that.
But all those of you without your computers or whatever that aren't recording this in any sort of reusable format, much less searchable format, I mean... You know,
so what about using stuff like Wiki and RSS feeds in Moodle? Like, I mean, Joe and I were talking about, we really, we are not technologists, you know what I mean? Like, we've had support in getting it up this far.
Right.
We like to have it with some RSS feeds and with some wikis and stuff on there, so it becomes much more interactive, much more intuitive. You know, is that happening?
I can show you the RSS stuff.
Okay. Typically, and there's a lesson here, typically when you set up a website account with an internet service provider, they provide one button access to things like wikis and RSS and so on. You just go to your site administrator, and quite literally it's, install a wiki, click here. And it comes back, here is the URL for your wiki, have fun.
Yeah.
So.
But for us, it's also that thing about which wiki or which blog. Because, you know, like I started off with Blogger, and I found that it was not doing the things I wanted to do.
Right.
And so I moved to another one. And so I still have a learning, it's almost like it's a pre-learning process you have to go through.
Yep.
So you get comfortable with saying to your ISP, I want to use this blog or this wiki.
You're going through the standard curve for blogging. The standard curve for blogging is start with Blogger, work at it for a little while. If you're still doing it in 6 months, move to a better system.
Yeah.
And your Blogger posts won't disappear. I mean, they're hosted by Google. They'll be there forever. But, you know, you just move on to a new system once you become more comfortable. So a lot of people never leave Blogger because they're happy with it. But when you know specifically what it is that Blogger doesn't do that you want, you now have the parameters for the selection of your replacement system, whatever that may be.
But a lot of
these internet service providers, really, if you're moving from Blogger, you're looking at your own website. And if you're looking at your own website, then your choices are to try to build something yourself in your living room or in your office and run it off your own computer, or to go with an internet service provider. And with very few exceptions, I say, go with an internet service provider. Because life is too short.
I don't want to spend my
time. To be providing 24/7 service on a computer sitting in your living room.
Yeah.
And because they will have, if they don't demand them, well, if they don't, offshore it. They will have one button access to a wiki, one button access to a content management system, one button access probably to WordPress, maybe to movable type, but that's less likely these days. But one button access to blogging software. And then if it's still not doing what you want it to do, learn PHP and code it yourself.
Thank you.
We're going to have to close it off. Sorry. Okay, I was going to move on and give a bit of a TAFE perspective, and Stephen, I come from one section of TAFE, and there are two other people who are going to give a short presentation, so you'll just see one side of it from me. Currently, TAFE Tasmania is moving through the implementation of a flexible learning policy that will overall enhance the access to education and training for our clients. And part of my role in TAFE Tasmania is to manage the unit known as Learning Media Services, which essentially is a resource development and systems support unit for teachers to enable teachers to access material if they want and use within the system. I have to be bold enough to say that TAFE is always a poor cousin to the Departments of Education and the universities in Australia, so we don't get into the systems development such as LEAP and that sort of thing. Some of the things we are doing at the moment is that we manage for the teachers in TAFE Tasmania the WebCT system. How much longer for, we don't know, because we have entered into a research project with one of our teaching teams who is also experimenting with Moodle. So we're finding that quite an interesting process that we're working on. We have a very close relationship with the Learning Edge, and although they are an enterprise body, we find them very good to work with, and I think they are affordable at this stage within our area. And we've entered into that agreement as an R&D process over the next 2 to 3 years, and we'll continue to do that. And I think, interestingly there, some of the work that I am a little bit passionate about in DRM is coming out to play within that Learning Edge system, and that is proving quite interesting for us. We're also then involved in a number of national projects through the framework, which you have no doubt some involvement and understanding of, where we're looking at a whole range of interoperability systems for both content and access to a range of other services. And we've been fortunate enough this year to have the Learning Edge come along and be part of that in the Learning Object Repository project, where we'll have four repositories dotted around Australia that will trade VET, or Vocational Education and Training, learning objects free of charge to the recipients at the other end. And we'll have that trial done by the end of this year and report on that, and hopefully we'll continue beyond that next year.
With a published API.
Yes. Thanks, Steve. Hand in hand with that project, we're involved in a national project that's looking at metadata for vocational education and training. So we've taken LOM and created a VET profile for that, which has been a struggle, and we're agreeing nationally that that is a very fluid document and will continue to evolve. Over and above all of that, we then have this interoperability project that is looking at the particular standards, etc., that we should use. And then at the content level, we're repackaging what are known as toolboxes into toolbox learning objects. And one of the other speakers from TAFE is going to talk a little bit how he's probably used some of those in some mobile technology. So there's some very interesting things going on, but at the same time, the goalposts tend to shift all the time. And I think one of my descriptions of you this morning was that you're an athlete in thinking and writing, and when we think we're just about catching up, you're just outstretched ahead of us again. So.
Sorry.
No, no, it's challenging. I think that's fantastic. But I don't have any specific questions. I wanted to give you a bit of a shot of what we're doing. And I'm very interested in your debate on SCORM, because that one bothers me immensely.
Sure. Okay. My first question is, when is lunch?
You said 11:20 and you went to 11:35, I think, at one stage. Right. So I couldn't stop you. It's 12:30.
Oh,
are you going to be able to hold out for that long?
Well, I'm just thinking 2 hours is about my limit. So. Okay. Yeah, I thought we were going to...
It hasn't been delivered yet, or it is being delivered? I hope there's a bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I function on, like, my fuels are caffeine and nicotine. So, and I have proof that we have been here for 1 hour, 57 minutes, and 39 seconds.
And you're telling me that I've got 2 minutes and
20
seconds?
Yeah. So also, too, I want to cut off the tape at 2 hours, because, you know, the longer this goes, the more less stable it gets, I'm sure. And I don't want
to
lose.
We're very close to being at lunch, and I'm happy as the chair to...
This same group is meeting after lunch, right?
Yes,
and the lunch is here, right?
Yes.
May I recommend we break for lunch now and start up again a little earlier this afternoon, and then we can take a break in the middle of the afternoon, and that way...
Good point. I don't think anyone will knock
that. Is that cool?
Yeah. Well done. All right. Thank you.
Thanks.